Is your family a success?
Is there even a measure for family success?
We think there is. And with a 20-year track record of success, we're going to show you how to bless your family with success in your health, relationships, and finances. I'm Steve Keene.
And I'm Katie Keene. And along with some awesome guests, we are going to give you our secrets to family success. Welcome to Family Success Secrets.
Welcome, everybody. Today we have with us Mr. Brad Baldridge. He is a college funding specialist who has helped thousands of families plan and save for college with smart and proven strategies to save time, money, and stress. As a financial expert, blogger, and host of the Taming the High Cost of College podcast, Brad has been sharing his college planning insights with clients, subscribers, and listeners for nearly 20 years. He teaches parents the best way to save and pay for college, including find the right school, maximize financial aid and scholarship, avoid student loan debt, and make your children's college dreams come true without wiping out your finances or retirement. Since 1998, Brad has become one of the nation's leading college planning and college financial experts. He offers life-changing advice through his private practice, his online platforms, and at numerous workshops, seminars, and events each year. So, Brad, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, could you explain for the listening audience what it is that you do, and perhaps, you know, how'd you get into that? Because I know your background. I remember your background did not start with anything that even sounded like this. So you want to share with folks what it is you do, why you love it, how you got started, those kinds of things.
Right. So I'm one of those people that whose career took a hard left turn. So I started out with an engineering degree and worked in industry for about 5 years. And I got involved in rental real estate and then personal finance pretty heavily while I was, you know, working my day job as an engineer. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed it so much that I made a career change into financial planning, 95-ish. And then from there, so as I was doing financial planning, I got more and more involved in college planning. So then I launched a specialty business as well, Baldridge College Solutions, where I help families specifically with planning and paying for college. And I work a lot with what I call late stage college planning, which is I've got a 17-year-old, I've got a sophomore, junior, senior, and it's, you know, it's go time. We really got to figure this out. We got to do it now. All the different visits and all the planning that you need to do. And again, some people have saved a big pile of money and they can pay for it, but they still got to plan how to spend their money wisely. And of course, most of us didn't plan for college to be as expensive as it is. So many times we're trying to figure out how we're going to fill the gaps as well.
I see. Well, that's pretty interesting. You started off with engineering and ended up with college planning and whatnot. I assume that there are some similarities, but if you took a hard turn into the financial world, then I know that that can be quite different from engineering. I guess you must really like it, right?
I do. Very much. And yeah, it's all kind of similar, a lot of numbers, a lot of problem solving, a lot of complex rules. And so it all works together.
Okay, fair enough. So you said you help folks more with the late stage planning. Is that because that happens to be what you sort of specialize, or is that what you find to be most common with your clients, that folks have that moment where they're like, oh dear,
well, right,
you got to do something quick.
Right. Well, a little bit of both, but because I started giving presentations at high schools when I started getting involved, I found that people are very motivated to get it figured out because they, you know, again, there's a deadline coming and it's coming fast for most families. Yeah. And people with 6-year-olds and 12-year-olds didn't show up at these presentations. Just people that were, you know, realizing that it was time to really figure it out were showing up. So kind of by default, I guess, I started working mostly with high school families and realized that there was a lot that they could do and should do. And then my specialty kind of went from there. It's like they were the people I'm helping. So I got better at it and I learned there's a lot more strategies. So I talked about that more and it kind of a snowball effect, of course.
I see. Okay. So we have a wide range of listeners in our audience. So maybe we can start with that late stage planning and kind of see where it goes. So what is it that you typically see or find that people are experiencing in maybe that last year? Maybe their kid's a high school senior and mm-hmm. has been accepted to a college, or maybe they're a junior and they're applying for college, and this is now the first time they're thinking about how they're going to afford it, how they're going to even pay for it, rather.
Right, exactly. And I think that's right. So a lot of the time I do get, again, the juniors and seniors, ideally juniors, because, there's lots you can do, but we need time to do the planning and figure it out. So if you have any ability at all to not wait till the senior year, it'll make your life a whole lot simpler and easier and give you more opportunity to plan well. But I guess what we find is most people don't really understand what college is going to cost when they first start looking around. And then when they see that first brochure with an actual price tag in it and realize that it's crazy expensive, or at least relative to what parents paid for sure, that it's like, oh my God, what are we really going to sign up for this? And how does this work? And we've heard about financial aid and scholarships. Maybe we need some of that. But it's complex and getting worse because, again, there's various programs out there to help. And then you got to understand all the options and how they fit together. So ideally, I would recommend people start sophomore, junior year.
Okay.
I would say late stage planning is, and maybe even freshman if you've got a complex situation. Again, a couple examples of complex. I have a family that has twin juniors and twin sophomores right now.
That sounds expensive.
Right. So they're, literally running around the country visiting schools all over the place. And they got to do it in a very tight time frame. And, hopefully they can find, we always make a joke, maybe they can find a place where they can buy three, get one free or something. But the kids probably won't be together at this point is what we've decided. But anyway, so there's a lot of different challenges like that. And in blended families, and I know you've got some special needs podcast listeners as well, those things make things more complex. So if you need to find a school that can handle learning disabilities or physical disabilities or whatever it might be, now it's an extra layer of, well, how do we find those types of schools? And many schools will advertise that they do this and that. And we all know, just like everything else in life, some do it better than others. And a school that might be great for deaf special needs may not be great for blind special needs. Or maybe they've got a great learning center for learning disabilities, but not so good with wheelchairs or whatever it might be. So there's a wide range of needs that families have, and there's a wide range of schools out there. There's about 4,000 colleges out there. And how do you figure out which ones to visit? How do you figure out which ones are a good fit? That can take that's a process that I think families can start sophomore, junior year. Mm-hmm. So then it gets ugly, and the complexity is there's things that parents do, there's things that students do, and there's things that you can do together. And that's where I think starting early is, even if your student's not ready to visit a college or really jump into true college planning, as a parent, you probably have an idea that it's coming, and you can do some of the parent work, which would revolve around the financing. It would be the big one for most parents is, how are we going to pay for this? Right or wrong, the system is kind of set up to make it the parent's responsibility. If the parents earn money, they disqualify the student from some aid packages and that type of thing. Even if the parents are saying that they not willing to help or, don't want to help or whatever, it still works that way. It is a family process where, and again, there are exceptions. Students that don't have parents, or maybe they're part of the federal runaway program, or they're separated from military would be another big one where they've been active. Now they're considered independent, and they don't have to bring mom and dad into it. But the typical 18-year-old rolling out of high school, going off to college, will need to include mom and dad on the financial side of it.
I see.
And a lot of those parents are willing to help. They just need to figure it out and how they can help and what makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So if a family has, let's say, that rising junior in high school, what for the mom and dad, if they've done no planning to date, what should they be thinking about right away? What would be the thing that you would cue them in on as start here?
Right. So on the financial side, it's, you know, some of those obvious things like, do they already have a savings program that, you know, again, some families are very diligent, right? We just had a baby. We're putting $200 a month into their college fund. And we started that at age zero. And now we have, you know, $75,000, a good head start. Most of us didn't do that. Most of us said, oh my God, daycare and all that other stuff. And we didn't realize how expensive college was going to be. So most of us don't have a big pile of money, but maybe we've got some. But it's never too late to save, right? You can start with a junior or a sophomore or even a senior. You just don't have as many months in as if you started early. And then the dollars go up. I was just talking with a family today where they figured their college budget would be $3,000 a month. And they've got, well, again, they've got seniors in high school that are going to college in 2 months. So that's what it needs to be because they didn't set aside, you know, along the way. And again, I just saw the look on your face. Well, that's kind of shocking. And that's the shock that parents need to get over is, well, if you didn't save a lot, it could be $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month to make college work. Or $100,000 if you happen to have, you know, and again, sometimes families will have the money. Maybe it's set aside for a different purpose or is there a rainy day fund or something like that where, you know, talk with someone that had done well with Apple stock. So they had a couple $100,000 of Apple stock and they could choose to use that for college if they wanted to. It wasn't earmarked for anything in particular. They didn't really want to use it for college if they could figure out how to keep the cost down and not have to tap it, but they could. And that, you know, so those types of decisions as a family, you know, typically mom and dad, how much are we willing to spend? Because whatever the budget is, you can probably spend it these days. The most expensive schools have crossed $80,000 a year. So it can get very expensive.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying you have to spend that kind of money, and but you certainly can, and some do. But even your, you know, so that's, I guess, where I would start is get an idea of what schools might be a good fit. Are we looking far and wide or local? And then just try on the local state school for size. Go visit it if your student's ready. And again, they don't have to go there. You just, you know, that's a good place to start.
Sure.
Is a local state school. And then learn what it costs. Learn a little bit about how the aid might work at that particular school. Because that's probably your low-cost option.
Okay.
And many families, they're going to pay full price at that school. Because they're not going to qualify for much aid. Or the aid that they qualify for is just a loan or two, which doesn't sound a lot like aid. It's, you know, again, money you're going to, the student's going to pay back or mom and dad are going to pay back. Could be a loan to either.
Sure.
And we can delve into need-based aid at some point if you want. But the whole process, you know, there's the federal government programs and then the schools themselves offer scholarships and all that. But a typical average state school now is about $25,000 all in. Which would be tuition, room and board.
Or are you talking about per year?
Per year.
Okay.
$25,000 per year. So tuition is about, average is about 10, 11. Room and board is 10, 11. Books is 1,000. And personal expenses and a couple other things are in there to about 25. Now that's average. High cost states like New Jersey and Illinois are closer to 32, 35. The UC schools in California are 35. The other state schools, the general state schools are not, they're more like 25.
I see.
And then low cost Wyoming and Iowa and some of those might be more like 20 or even 18 or something like that.
I see. I did have to ask because I'm pretty sure that 25 is about what I paid for all 4 years, right?
Right.
Back when I was in college, right?
For sure. I think that would have covered it for me. It was about $5,500 a year, I think, the first couple of years anyway.
Right, right. Yeah, same. I got you. Well, I went to a state university on a Navy scholarship. So they took care of that. I do remember that they were questioning my in-state residency, though, because I'd been on active duty outside of the state for several years. And so when I came back, they wanted me to justify my in-state rate. And I kind of thought, why are you talking to me? I'm not the one paying the bill here, but I figured, you know, I'll do the work. That saves the Navy some money.
Right.
But I remember then thinking, oh, okay, it's $5,000 a year. And that's how I knew the price of it. So when you said 25,000, I'm like, is that for the whole thing? No, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's not right.
Exactly. Not even close. Okay. So mom and dad need to get planning. Obviously the takeaway here is as early as possible and to do that. And it's never too late. Although it would certainly behoove you to get started as quickly as possible. Yes. What about for the kid who's thinking, okay, I'm 17, I'm going to probably go out to college next year. Mm-hmm. What kind of planning advice do you normally provide for them, or what kind of questions do they normally have? What are they normally thinking about?
Right. Well, the student's responsibilities are the academics, of course. They need to perform well enough in high school to get accepted at the colleges that they're interested in, you know, and some kids have high goals and some don't. Then college testing, which is kind of up in the air because a lot of colleges are now going test optional. So although some colleges have gone test optional and come back now where they've said, we've decided we're going to reinstate tests. Mm-hmm. I don't think all of them will. I think many will stay test optional. So we're going to have a mix now. But the student obviously has to, you know, do the testing where required.
Okay.
Figure out what they want to be when they grow up and choose a major. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of times people try and start with a major, and sometimes it might be better to start with a career or start with an interest and then a career and then a major, whatever order that might be. Some students are very undecided. Some students are very focused.
Right.
So that can lead to challenges one way or the other. So that's what the student's doing. And then together, it would be, you know, actually doing the research on the colleges. What are they going to cost? Should we visit them? Do they have the majors we need? Are they close to home, far away? Is it urban and rural? Is it expensive or not? Is it public or private? You know, which of those things are relevant? And then the biggest challenge for both parents and students is, what is the net cost going to be? You know, as an example, Harvard and Yale, they list at about 80,000. But anybody under 75,000 or 100,000 is going to receive substantial aid, such that it'll probably be their low cost option. It'll be less to go to Harvard or Yale than it would be to the state school for most families under 100,000 of income, because they're extremely generous with aid.
I see.
Now, the challenge, of course, is you got to get accepted to Harvard or Yale, and that's the challenge, right? So some of these high-end schools are very hard to get accepted to, but if you do get in, the money will fall into place.
I see.
So that'll turn out well. Mm-hmm. That's the very high end. And then, you know, from there, you've got your local state schools where, again, maybe there's not a lot of aid available, but they're at a relatively low sticker price. You know, mm-hmm. So you don't get much aid, but they start at 25,000. A private school might start at 50 or 60, or in the case of the more expensive, 80. And the net cost there might be 25, or it might be 45, or it might be 65. So I think that's the challenge, is if you go in blind, you might discover that schools you picked happen to not fall into line and be very expensive.
So how long would it take a family to investigate so that they can understand the net cost between those different kinds of places? Because that sounds like a lot of work that you have to do on your own. And obviously it's going to be situational dependent from family to family. And so if you have four or five different schools that you have to think about, then you got to go try and pull all of that information and do all the applications for each of those things so that you have a basis of comparison. Is that like a year or two worth of process?
Right. That's why I recommend you start early. Because there's two systems. There's the need-based aid system and the merit system. Mm-hmm. You know, need-based aid is based on income and assets of mom and dad and the student. Again, most students don't have anything and they don't earn anything, or not enough to really move the needle. So a lot of times that goes away. But sometimes I had a student where grandma left $250,000 in a trust for college in the student's name. Mm-hmm. Well, that student spent $250,000 on college because it was there. The colleges knew it was there. So they didn't lower the price as much as they would have otherwise.
Yeah. So
had grandma left that to mom or dad, then, you know, it probably would have been quite a bit left over. Like grandma didn't know what grandma didn't know. And, you know, again, those are the challenges, right? Is really understanding, will I qualify for need-based aid and will I qualify for merit aid at each of the systems? Not all colleges give merit aid and not all colleges give need-based aid. Mm-hmm. So you need to, you know, and there's these different combinations. So, and this is what I spend a lot of time helping families through, because, you know, I can help calculate. There's a calculator on my website that helps you calculate your, what's called your EFC, your expected family contribution, which helps you figure out if you're going to qualify for need-based aid or not.
Okay.
And as a word of caution, a lot of people think they know the answer and they're wrong, because they say something like, well, my brother-in-law didn't qualify, therefore I'm not going to qualify.
Yeah.
But if your brother-in-law didn't apply to Harvard or Yale, then his case is not like your case. Or if his income is higher than your income or lower, or the student was more academically talented or less, all those things come into play depending on the colleges that you're looking at. So I think one of the challenges is most people don't want to go to a college and then discover that there was a very similar college, you know, across town that would have been $10,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 less. They just didn't know.
Right.
And to figure that out, you got to do the legwork. I mean, unfortunately, there's not, you know, it's just not easy. You will get the final price at the end of the process, but only for the colleges that you apply to, get accepted to, and do all the financial aid forms for. So if you pick six colleges and go through the process, you'll get the price for those six, but it might've been the wrong six. Sure. And that's where, you know, so there's strategies there. Like, I encourage everybody to apply to their local state school, mm-hmm. or their flagship in their state if they think they can get in. So like here in Wisconsin, we've got University of Wisconsin that most people have heard of in Madison, but there's also University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire and La Crosse and, you know, all the satellite schools that, you know, they're not very competitive compared to Madison. Madison, you got to be about top 10% of your class, strong test scores, strong grades. Mm-hmm. And if you can get into that school, it kind of puts all the other schools on notice that, hey, I've got a quality school at a good price, because it's a state school. So it's going to cost $25,000 full price. So if you're applying to Loyola or, you know, St. Louis University or even Harvard for that matter, they know based on, you know, your statistics, you're likely to get accepted to Madison. They know what Madison's price is. So, and they can choose to, you know, get in there and be close or not, but many colleges will if they really want you.
And why would they? I mean, just out of curiosity, if they've got thousands of people who are applying, it seems to me that they would go for those who are then capable of paying them top dollar rather than saying, okay, well, you know, I want to have all of these kids see that they could get in at their home school at, let's say, a third of the cost that it comes here. Well, why not just charge full price to whoever can come and pay full price?
Right. Well, and that's what Harvard and Yale can do, because they've got that cachet. So, but they also have the politics of, we're crazy expensive and we only admit the wealthy that can pay this huge price. So, and they've got billions of dollars in endowments to help.
Sure.
You know, and, you know, what goes on in their undergrad is is like 12% of their budget or something. It's inconsequential. You know, some wealthy person donates enough to pay for everybody every year at some of these schools, right? I mean, it's a small rounding error kind of thing for them. Now, many other schools, though, they are very tuition driven, which means they need to bring in enough revenue to cover their expenses. Mm. And every year they have to do that, but they don't have the pricing power to say, well, 80,000, they might say, well, we list at 65, but people aren't willing to pay 65. So maybe they have to bring their price down to 40 or 30 or 20. And that's, And that's what colleges are working hard at right now, is to figure out how do we not, you know, if we had 10 kids that were strong and all equal, if we offered all 10 of them a scholarship for $10,000, two would show up. If we offered a scholarship for $20,000, maybe three or four would show up. What's better? Well, there's a very complex better there for them, right? Are the seats empty? Or if they did that, would they have to hire another instructor? Or would they fill out a major that's suffering? Or would they cause overload in their dorm? So there's all kinds of, you know, and will they be profitable? All that stuff is all, you know, so colleges are playing this game and they're starting to use big data. So I think that's important for people to realize is.
And so they've probably got an army of people who are trying to crunch those numbers.
Exactly. So, right. So they're working with consultants and that kind of stuff, and they're tracking and paying attention to who's what's called demonstrating interest, who's visiting, who's signed up for the newsletters, who's opening our email, who's been to our website, who's acting like they're interested. And then what they do with that data is not clear, right? Sometimes they might say, if they go to the housing webpage, that's good. Or if they go to the housing webpage, that's bad. I don't know. That's what they're trying to figure out, right? Is we've got all this data, how do we interpret it? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean? But they're at least starting to collect it now. And, you know, some are further down that process than others.
And I assume a lot of them also take into account the cost of foreign students.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I'm sure that there's a different price scale for those folks.
Yes, generally that's a profit center for colleges.
Yeah, I mean,
full price.
I remember from my college days. And remember now, when I was in college for my undergrad, I was there on a Navy scholarship, but I had still heard in some way that many of the cost of the in-state students or the costs were subsidized by the price paid by the foreign students, because they were willing to pay probably an egregious amount of money to come to school in the United States. And so they would have entire portions of the campus, a building or two or housing developments that were for the foreign students.
Yes, absolutely. Especially the large research universities, where they can do that both at the undergrad level and at the grad level. Yes, that's essentially the United States is exporting education to very large dollar amounts by bringing students here and, you know, educating them and sending them, you know, some of them go home, some of them stay here, et cetera. But yes, for sure many colleges have figured out as the graduating classes are shrinking right now, they can fill the gaps with additional foreign students potentially. Mm-hmm. And that works well, again, if you've got the name brand, if you're University of Illinois or University of Wisconsin or Harvard or Yale or Berkeley, you know, you can pretty easily fill your, but if you're the smaller commuter college down the street, that might be a little tougher. They may not have as much access.
So can you give us an idea of what the domestic students, what's causing the exodus, if you will?
Oh, there's just fewer students born 18 years ago.
Really?
Therefore, there's less graduates right now. Just a general population trend. And I think there might be a little bit of, at one point we peaked at about 75% or 72% going off to college right after high school. And, you know, so there was a big growth spurt where the number of births was rising. So therefore the number of 18-year-olds was rising.
Sure.
And the percentage that went on to college was growing and growing and growing. Well, the prices of colleges have gotten to the point now where there's many families that are saying, is it worth it?
Yeah, I'll bother.
And again, especially for male students, you know, female students, you know, now there's a big shift there too. There's a lot more female students than male students at most places and most majors. There's a few exceptions, of course, but just because of the demographic of, you know, some of the other choices like plumber and electrician don't seem to appeal as much. Again, that's one of my theories. I'm sure there's much more than that to it, but.
Sure. Well, I mean, but my understanding is that there are some of those vocational type of work jobs, those technical type of jobs where a person can come out of high school, go to get a short-term vocational education, and they can come out starting at nearly six figures in some areas because nobody wants to be an electrician or an HVAC technician.
Yes.
Because they all wanted to go to college. Well, now that you see, well, the cost of college is 80 or let's say 50, 25, 50, $75,000 a year. And you're going to be paying for that for decades, right? And you're not going to recoup that money for such a long, long time versus the cost of a vocational education. And
right.
then you go into the workforce and now you've paid it off in your first year, if you're smart. And it's just right. onward and upward from there.
Right. And as and again, right. And a lot of parents talk about, well, you need an education. Mm-hmm. Education is good, right? Does it sure. need to be a 4-year on a campus somewhere, including the beer and pizza, or which, what parts of that is important, what parts aren't? Right. And, you know, there's, you know, you can argue, and there's a lot of different opinions, of course, around, well, it's not just what you learn in the classroom. It's the connections you make and, you know, the diversity that you're exposed to and all mm-hmm. those types of things, which is, you know, also valid. So I think there's going to be a place for what we have now, but I think there's a good chance, and it's happening a lot in adult education now, where there is some online or hybrid versions where you do some learning online and some in person. And maybe it's alternating weekends or something and or evenings or whatever it is, right? Or on demand. It just depends.
I see.
That hasn't taken off with the 18-year-old again because, you know, again, in my opinion, there's a whole lot of parents that have a lot of nostalgia around the great college experience and they want that for their kids. Mm-hmm. And the price goes up and they're willing to pay it. And the price goes up some more and they're still willing to pay it. So again, if the supply and demand question, well, if they raise the prices and they still come, why not raise prices?
Well, from a profit standpoint, they no reason not to.
Right. Well, and again, it helps. And the other challenge with education is it's a high service industry. In other words, you want to have a lot of smart people who are paid well, giving our kids one-on-one attention. Well, that doesn't scale, right? I mean, as soon as you add a few more students, now you need more smart people. Right. And it's very expensive. Whereas the typical, you know, factory says, well, we had 500 workers and we made 1,000 widgets, but now we have half as many workers and we made twice as many widgets because we are more efficient. Mm-hmm. You don't want to hear that in your hospital and you don't want to hear that in education, right? We're down to one instructor that teaches all 12,000 students. Well, you know, that's obviously the extreme, but
sure. But I was in classrooms with 300 students,
right?
In a big auditorium for economics 101.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it was okay. But a selling point at the private college is our economics 101 only has 40 students or 20 students, mm-hmm. and you get to have a discussion instead of a lecture.
I see.
And it's, and that's why you're paying a little more for the private school is mm-hmm. the one-on-one, right? I call it the Dead Poet Society effect, right? Where you want to have that moment like they did in Dead Poet Society. Yeah. I remember that movie, but
sure.
Robin Williams changed the life of a couple of young people. Mm-hmm. That happens at colleges. And I've had a lot of parents say it happened to me. And you know, I want my kid to go experience that.
I see.
Whether or not that'll happen is a, you know, completely different question, of course, but mm-hmm. it is potentially possible.
Sure. So out of curiosity, because we've been kind of talking about going to a school because of a particular major or a place where they have a strength. What about the kid who's perhaps undecided and now at $25,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, they change majors partway and now they incur an additional year or two of that. Any trends in that you've discovered?
Well, right. I mean, so some of the state universities have made it hard for kids to graduate in 4 years because it's hard to get your classes. And then if you change majors, then it gets even worse because now some of the courses you took don't count towards graduation. And
right.
So it extends things. And parents, all you hear, all you can think about is, well, another year of college is another year of all these expensive. And that's true. So there's a lot more pressure now to get it right the first time. Sure. And of course, as someone who has an engineering degree and made a hard left turn, I mean, the reality of it is, in many cases, you may not get it right. And I don't know what the solution to that is. Like back when I was in college, it wasn't unusual to run across that kid that changed his major 3 times and he's on his 7th year.
Yeah.
But from a financial perspective in today's situation, that's not good. Obviously you want to get done in 4.
There you go.
And there's that, I have a podcast where I talked with, they're actually working on some 3-year degrees now. Mm-hmm. Where they're piloting and they're not just taking 4 years of material and trying to squeeze it into 3 years. They're kind of starting over from the ground up and saying, well, what's important and what isn't, and how do we extend to, get more of the positive and less of the negative and get done in 3 years. So whether that will take off or not, there's a couple colleges out there that are offering it in select degrees. But that's an example of, innovation that might stick.
I see.
There's a whole lot of, 4+2 or 2+2 or where you do, undergrad and end up with a master's degree or even a doctorate degree in 6 years, mm-hmm. or you go 2 years to this school and 2 years to that school and it saves some costs.
I see.
I think the challenge is you need another layer of complexity that you need to understand, buyer beware of, does it really work? And they're getting better at it. And most of them do, but occasionally you hear about someone that, I took the wrong math class. That one didn't transfer. Now I have to take math again.
Yeah. I mean, that did happen to a family member who was at a private school getting a degree in mathematics, went to a state school and said, well, you can't start where you left off over there because all those math courses, 1, 2, 3, they don't transfer. Well, what sense does that make? I mean, calculus is calculus, right? So
yeah.
Why would it not?
Yes. But, and again, there's two edges of that, two sides of that story, right? Is if we're going to have graduates that claim they know calculus, but they didn't learn it here, how do we know they learned it at all? So, little quality control on their graduates, and especially in the private schools, a little bit of, well, if they're going to get a degree with our name on it, they should take classes and pay us for that privilege versus just transfer in and take a few courses and graduate here.
Right. So does that happen? So for the kids who think, oh, well, I'm going to take care of all the general education requirements at a community college at a lower cost and then transfer into a state university for my final 2 years to hit the things that are relevant for my major. Do they hit obstacles with that typically because of any of these problems?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if it's typical or not. And like I said, it's getting better. Like state legislatures have kind of come down on the state systems and said, you got to make it so they can transfer, right? Yeah. Do whatever it takes to get, everything up to snuff so that we don't have to deal with this. Cause this is, that's not acceptable. And some states have done a better job than that, than others. And then in the private areas, a lot of colleges are doing it a little bit on purpose of saying, well, these are our feeder schools. You can go to these schools and take 1 year or 2 years. And if you take these pre-approved courses, we know they transfer.
Oh, I see.
But again, it's one of those things where you want to make sure that you understand what's going on at both institutions before you commit to that, just to verify that, okay, math 101 here is transferable, but 102 is not. So I can't just take 102 because I couldn't get into 101. I have to fight to get into 101 somehow.
Sure. So you got to choose wisely.
And that's where, again, all the stuff we're talking about is not hard. It's just time and effort and paying attention and starting early enough that you have time to do it all and do it well.
Mm-hmm. That does sound like it's a very, very complex system to have to navigate. Really, no matter what it is that you want to do, there's so many considerations that I assume most people haven't even thought about, or maybe they don't even know that they need to consider those kinds of stuff. So surely for the folks who are listening today, they can go to your websites and figure that kind of stuff out. Is there similar stuff available for other folks? I mean, would other folks know by talking, to the high school guidance counselor, all of these different considerations? Or is this the kind of stuff that's just not being shared with the public?
Right. So the high school counselors, again, there's a wide variety of, quality there. One big issue, I think, is in a lot of high schools, there's not enough counselors for the number of students that they're trying to help. So they really can't go too deep in anything. Mm-hmm. And then especially in public schools, not only are they dealing with college and college planning and all that stuff, but also the teen pregnancy and the bullying and the,
right,
active shooter drills and all the other stuff that, mm-hmm. It all lands on them, and they, they do the best they can. But my bit of advice there is get in line so you get some help. If you don't raise your hand and say, I need help, a typical counselor at some of these high schools is there's, one person they're working with and two waiting at all times. So they don't spend a lot of time trying to figure out, well, who needs my help? They just, they're standing right in front of them. So if you're not in that line, you could get overlooked for, the entire high school career, because they're busy helping people that are asking for help. And, and again, they try. I mean, I don't want to throw these people under the bus. They work hard and they do the best they can. That's one piece of it. The other piece of it is for parents, they help a lot with students and majors and what do I want to be when I grow up? The whole financial side is really not their thing. That's not what they've been trained in. It's not kind of their job. And, I guess my opinion, what I'd love for them to do is at least warn parents that, the financial side of college is complex. Get started. And whatever that means, right? Call Brad or go to the website or whatever it is. But because I think a lot of parents don't realize what they're up against. I always make the comment of, I've never, ever had a parent say, I started this too early. But I've had a whole lot of parents tell me I've started this too late. Mm-hmm. Because there's, again, it's a big project and it can fill just about any amount of time you have in the details. If you can do it a little better if you need to. So that's kind of the lay of the land. And so I think on another important thing to realize is there's a growing community of professionals out there that are filling these gaps. So there are what are called private, independent education consultants. And they work with students on those, the issues that we've talked about, what do you want to be when you grow up? What's a good major? How do you find a school that's a good fit? Would you do well at the big thriving university with the major football team and the et cetera, et cetera? Or are you better off to go a small, quaint, comfortable place that might be a better fit for you? Mm-hmm. Or something in between, of course, right? And special needs and all the other challenges that may come up. There's some that specialize in special needs as well to help you guide you. Their job is to visit schools and understand schools and kind of be that matchmaker. At least some of them do that. And then myself on the financial side, I tend to work with parents as an example. I'll meet the students I'm working with, maybe 30 or 40%. But if it's can you help me with my essay or what? Can you help me figure out what I want to be when you grow up? Well, I have an engineering degree. And I have a lot of knowledge in the financial side. It's not really my thing, to get involved in that. There are people out there and we can refer you to somebody, but I'm more along the lines of, well, once you figure it out, we'll figure out how to pay for it. We'll make sure you, are picking schools that are a good fit financially. We'll figure out need-based aid and merit aid. And that's where we get into the kind of, there's the strategies and tactics of, if I do this, I get that, right? So if I'm go to Harvard and I can lower my income because I'm a business owner, well, that will help me get more aid at Harvard. May not help me at all at a state school, but at Harvard, I lower my income, I get more aid. And how do I, so let's come up with some lower my income strategies, similar to tax planning, right? Or retirement planning. If you put money in your 401k, you pay less taxes. So once you know that, you can use that to your advantage if it makes sense. Well, there's all that kind of stuff around college as well of how do I qualify for need-based aid? Are there things I could do or should do to qualify for more? Saving and investing? Am I, taking all the tax advantages I can get? Am I putting enough money away? How do I deal with multiple kids in school all at the same time?
That's a lot.
Divorce and blended families, business owners, you know, so there's athletes. If you have an athlete that has a shot at scholarships, or even an athlete that just wants to play, mm-hmm. and probably is not scholarship material, but they'd love to sail at, you know, I don't know. I can't think of a school that has a sailing team, but Harvard does, or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. Or if they want a defense at Arizona State, well, again, another complexity of, you can say you want a fence at Arizona State, but if the coach doesn't want you, you're not, it's not going to work. So
yeah,
if it's important defense, you might have to go where the coaches will take you, versus pick a school and then hope you can be on the team. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, there's a process starting early. I've got a, on my website and podcast, you know, this is the stuff we talk about on the podcast. This is the stuff that, you know, there, and there's some resources there. Scholarship Guide for Busy Parents helps you understand the scholarship landscape. The EFC calculator help you with need-based aid. Obviously we've got 140 some podcast episodes where I talk to the various experts that I've mentioned, and other professionals and college professors and college presidents, and mm-hmm. just kind of all the different avenues. And yeah, so that, I guess, is probably the big things. And then obviously if you people want to reach out directly, you know, I help families one-on-one with their college needs, and
okay,
talk about that as well.
Very good. Very good. Well, there's more than we can possibly get to in the time that we have available for us in a single podcast. But before we get to where folks can find you, let's hit that last question of maybe one thing. And so we've talked quite a bit about starting early, but what is that one thing? Maybe something that is from your personal experience from when you were getting ready for college, or from what you've seen in your professional expertise with helping so many families over the course of the year, something that would help folks that they could take away today and say, you know what, I'm going to implement that right away. And that'll be a help for our family right away.
Right. Anything? Absolutely. So I would say, understanding that college planning is a process. It's not an event. You don't say, well, today we're going to figure out our college and be done. It's more of a process where, well, let's go visit some schools and see what we learn. Based on what we learn, let's do whatever the next step is. And based on that step, maybe we're going to visit different schools now. And, you know, I'm going to test and discover that my test scores are great, so I can go to these types of schools, or I discover they're not so good and I have to change my list, or, you know, so it's a process that. And if you start early and do it a little low pressure, sophomore and junior year, just to get your feet wet. Okay. And like anything else, if you've got, you know, a number of kids, the oldest is the guinea pig. By the time you get to the last kid, you've got it all figured out. Or at least you think you do, unless they throw you a curve and do something different than what you're used to. So yeah, I would say that would be it. It's kind of a process. If you look around, you know, I talked a lot about the challenges, but you notice there's a lot of college kids out there. So people are figuring it out.
Right.
So it can be done. You just want to try and do it as efficient as you can.
I see. Is there a place where a person can find a roadmap, something that's a little bit of a guide that says, here's at least some of the things you should think about in your process, knowing that they'll all be different, of course.
Right. Yeah. And again, I'm building a course. So there's a course available on my website where it'll kind of, you know, walk you through it. In my podcast, there's a 10 episode series where I worked with an education consultant that talked about the student stuff. And we hit kind of the 10 big topics. So 10 episodes, that would be a great place to start, where we talk about, again, the kind of the key things of choosing a major, visiting schools, need-based aid, scholarships, you know, the 10 core topics that if you got your feet wet by listening to that, would be a good place to start.
That does sound like a great place. And both of those, both course that folks can go through and a place where they can listen in and then sort of get a great set of ideas at least. Hey, this is where I start. So with that, where can folks find you online and whatnot?
Right. So everything is at tamingthehighcostofcollege.com. So the podcast is there. And of course, the podcast is also wherever else you get podcasts under Taming the High Cost of College. But at tamingthehighcostofcollege.com, there's also the other resources that we've talked about, blog posts and, you know, student loan guides and scholarship guide for busy parents. And
I see.
Access to the course, access to myself, my phone number, all that stuff is all available at that website.
Nice. So folks, we'll have that in the show notes, tamingthehighcostofcollege.com. And that way folks, when they come in and take a look, when you take a look at the stuff that we have there, it'll show you just how you can find Brad at his website, how you can get in touch with him. So that was great. Brad, thank you so much for all the time, all of the ideas and the wisdom, the experiences and whatnot that you've shared with us today. I'm sure that it will be a blessing to many families, especially those who have put it off perhaps towards the back end of the time that they have left available. So that's really good. We appreciate your time and thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was great.
Absolutely. All right.
Thanks for listening and spending time with us today. If you know anyone who could benefit from this podcast, we would be honored if you would share it. Please rate, review, subscribe, and download.
Head over to podcast.familysuccesssecrets.com to have a top-rated family success secret sent straight to your inbox. We look forward to spending time with you again next week during our next episode. See you then.
Bye, everyone.